There's a huge political risk in the next 10 years for Australia that no one is accounting for. And that is when, over the last decade, the land values of industrial in Melbourne grew 281%, Sydney 280%, 28% a year. That beats every residential market.
How much was that property? And what did the next few deals look like? And how did you fund those deals?
Yeah, so
Scott O'Neill is the CEO and founder of the Rethink Group, Australia's leading commercial property buyers agency.
He has guided thousands of investors in securing over $5.75 billion in real estate and is widely regarded as an authority in property investment.
The lower the yield, the lower the perceived risk. But what people are doing is they're paying more for the same risk.
What made the change going instead of just continuing residential like everybody else does?
It's a really topical question. So this is quite important to this day and age right now because
what's up, guys, and welcome to another episode of Unemployable Podcast. Today, we have another unbelievable podcast around property. And we've got a very, very special guest that is flew all the way up here from Sydney just to be here with us today. And that's Scott O'Neill. Scott O'Neill owns Rethink Group. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for the invite, guys.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I was actually talking to Carson off camera and asking, how do you guys know each other? And he's like, I don't. I just reached out to him. So it's great. I love that, you know, we're getting out there and people are starting to understand what Unemployable is all about and what makes it on the pod.
That's the amazing thing about podcasts. We get so many people saying, oh, you know, I'm in my own little bubble and I started listening to this podcast. And you're literally only an email or a phone call or a message on social media away from making connections with some of those people that you've seen on podcasts. It's crazy.
So the reason why you guys are going to want to listen very carefully today is Scott O'Neill from Rethink Group has the biggest commercial buyer's agency in Australia and New Zealand. He's also been on the Young Rich List under 40 with a net worth in excess of 150 million and sold over $5.5 billion in real estate over the last 10 years. And there was an article that we were just talking about off camera that 10 years ago, he started with about 60,000. And turn it into $150 million in 10 years, which is an amazing feat. So I just want to say well done and congratulations on that.
Cheers, mate.
And we got Carson on again. And for those of you guys that don't know who Carson is, Carson was a coaching client of ours here at Unemployable, met about 14 months ago. And what they've done in the last 4 years has been unbelievable as well. They've done over $100 million in land subdivision sales, cut up over 170 lots of land. And 4 years ago, this guy was literally cleaning carpets for many, many years on about $1,000 a week, this humble character here.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm keen to unpack Scott's story. Commercial is something I've always been interested in, and I'm always consuming as much content as I can and come across Scott's stuff all the time. So looking forward to unpacking it.
Be good. Awesome, thanks for being here again. And Mark, we join again forces. Mark's been with us from the beginning. Obviously, for those of you guys, there's a lot of new subscribers. So just explaining who everyone is once again. And Mark's been with us since the beginning. Very successful entrepreneur in his own right. Obviously been in land sales, done over 3,000 land sales himself in Victoria over the years. And now he's, I guess, a detail trader, okay? Going into detail on trading and macro markets and crypto and whatnot. So glad to have you on, and thanks again for being on.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. It's going to be a great story.
So where do we start, Scott? I guess maybe take us back to, I guess, 10 years ago when you had $60,000 in a dream, I guess. And I guess we'll unpack the last 10 years. And I want to unpack it into detail because we love the vanity metrics, right? The 150 million is an amazing thing. But what we really want to teach the people listening, right, is kind of a step-by-step process on how the hell does a guy that's 28 years old with $60,000 turn that into what you've done in 10 years? And not only that, you've done it in business and you've done it in real estate. And those are two topics that we love teaching about. And that's where Shannon and Carson come into play with us creating unemployable property and us doing more of these property podcasts.
Yeah, so that 10-year period, you've got to go back another 5 years, actually. So I bought my first property, which is just a house with a little granny flat, 2010, just after the GFC in Sydney. And that 60 grand, that was just an AFR article, referred to the deposit I saved. And that was saved during a multiple of jobs through like bartending to McDonald's. It was basically uni. And even I was working during the school years. So that deposit went into a 90% loan into a house in Sydney. And that house barely grew for a year or so after, because that's after the GFC, the credit crunch. Like, it's pretty nerve-wracking time to be in property, especially my entire net wealth, and then chuck another $450,000 loan on top of it. So it was big dollars for me at the time. And it was nerve-wracking. So it was a slow start. Got into property, not much happened. Bought the second property 2012, towards the end of 2012. That was an owner-occ purchase back in Sydney, just in a place called Maroubra. We just bought out without using investment metrics. And that was a mistake. That was one of the things I shouldn't have done. It was a low-yielding deal. It had strata. It was kind of everything you don't want in a deal when you're looking for cash flow. Then moved to a place called Port Macquarie. So I was always chasing a career. I was doing an MBA. I wanted to be like a CEO. That was kind of like play the corporate ladder game. That was, I knew I had it in me. I understood big business. I was comfortable with big numbers. So why not do it for someone else? And I moved to Port Macquarie, and it was just one of those backbreaking jobs, like working 6 days a week. Like I was managing, at the age of 24, over 150 people. It was basically concrete plants, trucks, mines. It was basically like the building industry game, but the product side of things. So, you know, you're dealing with unions, you're dealing with staff issues, it was a hard yards job at the time. And in between all this, I was thinking, this sucks. I don't want to do this forever. Like, my next promotion was to be the estate GM, and that would have been at the age of 40. So I was like, what am I going to do for 15 years? Do this same job? Because there was a real age limit to it. It was what, like, engineering firms are kind of like that. They're very staged process. You've got to have this amount of experience. Like, it's hard to cut corners from a career point of view. So time was the only solution I saw, which made property sound more exciting. And where it all started, I found a unit block in Port Macquarie, a little full pack. This thing was yielding 10% yield. It was super cheap. We're talking 425 grand. It was old, you know, fibro looking thing, but, four places renting for 250 bucks a week, not bad. And by the time you took all the outgoings and all that with the mortgage, it was about 25 grand clear in the pocket. So I thought, if I find 5 to 10 of these at the time, I'll never get to work again. So I just lasered onto that process and bought up in Gold Coast, bought up in places like Cooma. I bought many unit blocks at the time because my angle was strata titling them, creating equity. And that created more money than I was making through my fairly well-paying job at the time. And commercial only came first time in 2015, which was a little place in Perth, supermarket, like a deli, and then fish and chip shop. That was where it's all changed for me at that point. Got into commercial, and fast forward a few years, bought, you know, 30 odd more properties. Like, we've got over 70 tenants, and they range from like supermarket Audi, chemist warehouse, to medical facilities, to engineering firms, all sorts of tenants. We've created an income through that where we don't have to work anymore, basically. So business is the stuff on top.
So there's a lot to unpack there.
I was just going to say, we always refer to the person that's, you know, the nurse or the person that's working the fiery or that working the job and doesn't want to work the 9 to 5 because it's backbreaking or whatever. But there's also a lot of people in this day and age that are working the corporate job that's mentally taxing and breaking people mentally. And, you know, I used to call it a high paying apprenticeship being in those roles, but this is going to be a great story to those people out there that are working in that job that is mentally cooking them as well, because there's so many other options out there.
So what was it inside of you, like, going from doing an MBA, want to climb the corporate ladder, to then this realization of, you know, I want to get into property? Was there a mentor? Was there a friend? Anything that influenced you to?
It's something I've never really had a mentor or besides probably the old property magazines. I just saw others doing stuff from afar and thought, well, I'm early on in the journey. I've seen what they've got. Just extrapolate that over 10 years and I'm there. So it was really just seeing what others were doing. The commercial was all like just self-taught. There was still to this day, there's no one out there commercial investor besides like the Goodmans of the world. And that, no one relates to that. That's ASX type stuff. But I just sort of looked at the spreadsheet and go, I'm making more in property, even at this early stage, than my corporate job. And I'm investing 60 plus hours a week into this corporate job. I'm putting 5 hours a week into this. So it's a no-brainer. I just followed the numbers.
And most people start off in residential, right? I've started off in residential. Obviously, you guys have started off in residential, and so have you, Mark, right? What made the change going instead of, you know, just continuing residential like everybody else does,
yep,
and going into commercial? Because commercial really is, you know, I guess it's a bit scary for people, right? Because it's a lot easier going, all right, let me buy a house. I know there's plenty of people that need to rent it. Usually you can get into it for a little bit cheaper than a commercial property. You always hear the scary stories of, you know, commercial tenancies being vacant for long periods of time and people not paying their rent. And then you got to lock them out. And then you got this full factory full of stuff that you got to get rid of and put it on Gumtree and Facebook Marketplace and all this type of thing. So yeah. Where did that transition come from residential to commercial? Because there's a lot of people that listen to this that are first-time investors,
yeah,
are looking to invest, and majority are probably residential investors, you know, yeah, thinking about getting into commercial.
It's a really topical question. So this is quite important to this day and age right now, because my situation back then with the unit blocks, I was onto a winning streak. I was like, there was margin, like you're buying 8%, well, 8 to 10% gross yielding properties. You shave off all the outgoings, you're sitting at 6, 7% net. The mortgages back then were probably in the fives, low fives. So there's a 2% margin on the debt for that, for a unit block. Now those same unit blocks, because of all the capital growth they've had and the rent growth hasn't kept up, they're probably like 6% gross. Now they're 4% net, probably 3.5% to be, yep, fair, because you've got to put real maintenance in there and stuff like that. And then your mortgage rate's 6.5. It does not stack. I worked that out back then, and now that stacks a whole lot worse now. So anyone that's still pumping that strategy is simply ignoring cash flow. They're going for a different strategy, which is hopefully it keeps growing at the same rate. I'm sure some places will, some places won't, but the return on investment's going to be a lot lower. Commercial, just stumbled upon that one deal. I was looking for over 12 months, so didn't stumble on it. I was like literally had spreadsheets of hundreds of properties and comparing them and trying to pick which one to go. But it was a 9% net versus a 5% interest rate. There was a 4% margin on the deal, 2 5-year leases, recession-proof type tenants. Like everyone's going to go to a supermarket. The fish and chip shop survived Perth for 35 years through their ups and downs. So whatever Perth has coming up, that people are still going to eat fish and chips, I guess. So I even did the DD on, like, you know, how old's the guy? Yeah, they got their succession plan. What's the business worth? What's the multiple of these things going? Like there's an asset in their business itself. And that's what I delved into and thought, all right, well, it's not as scary as some of the assumptions you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
Because if you get commercial wrong, everything you mentioned is perfectly right. You're going to get screwed. You're going to lose your tenant. You're going to have 6 months vacancy. If you pick the wrong asset, it's going to get scary pretty quick. So you got to do your due diligence and pick the right ones.
Yeah. And that's a key, right? And we'll dig into that deeper. What does due diligence mean? Because we throw this word around, but due diligence means work, yeah, right? And what type of work and what you need to be looking at. But can you explain to the audience the difference between residential and commercial, just in regards to the expenses that you incur on a residential property versus the expenses that you incur on a commercial property, and who pays what?
Yeah. So high level, when you look at residential property, everyone quotes gross yields. So, you know, 5% gross. What does that mean? You just get the rent, but then you've got to pay your insurance, your maintenance, your council rates, all of the above. There's a lot of expenses. And then you've got to factor that. So that might minus your outgoing. There might be 2, 2.5% off your net figures. So when you see 5 5% gross, it's really 2.5% to 3% net, depending on the asset. If it's strata, it's even worse. Commercial, the tenants pay for things like land tax. Not every lease, but even if they're not paying for it, you always work it back to a net figure and then adjust the price when you offer. So generally leases, there's two types, a gross lease and a net lease. A gross lease means they pay you more upfront to account for the outgoings. A net lease means you literally send the bill to the tenant, or even if you pay it and then they pay you in arrears the next month, but they pay insurance, land tax, property management in many cases. A lot of people are surprised by that one. There's a maintenance allowance in there. Capital work's not included because that's considered improving the building. Basically, everything to do with operating the building. And your job as a landlord is to provide the asset in a usable condition. So it can't, like, if it's leaking, you got to fix it, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. If you're not, you might be liable to, they cannot pay your rent if it's like, let's say it's flooded. We don't buy flood properties, but, there'd be a period of a week or so where you can't charge rent.
Yeah. So there's so many pros and cons to each. Like, just off camera, when Scott just came into the studio, I was literally like, just give me a sec, because I was literally texting, because our property manager at one of our properties was like, emergency, there's a water heater that's leaking very badly. They've had to turn it off. Had the plumber go out there. They want $2,700 for a new, water heater, plus $250 for the electrician to go out. And I'm just like, just hold off. I rang my plumber, man. Hey, can you go check this out and, make sure, can it be fixed, or what can we do? Whereas, commercial property, the tenant that I have in one of them, I don't hear from him. Like, I legit don't hear from him. And the only time I hear from him is if I'm late on sending him the invoice, to be honest with you. Yeah. Hey, it's the third or the fourth, just letting you know I haven't sent the invoice, if I'm overseas or something like that, because I haven't automated that one. But it's a different kettle of fish. And this is why I'm so interested in having you on as well, just because we're so fixed on residential property, right? And we have been for so long. I know I have been, and most of the people that I hang around with too do residential, and property development. And I've got one mate who's not mentored me, but basically I've been watching him, right, in the commercial space. And he just keeps buying and buying and buying and buying, to the point now where a friend of his is a commercial developer. But what they do is they do some new stuff, but they're experts in buying old commercial tenancies. So 15, 16, 25 units, and renovating them, to the point now where all they do is ring him and say, hey, we're doing this one, there's 18, we want to sell 15. And he's got a big finance broking business, and he's got a big Rolodex, and he just calls his mates and goes, hey, there's another one. And he literally takes all 15. So there's not even any agent fees at the same time.
Yeah.
And they just keep buying. And it's such an interesting model.
Yeah. Look, in Australia, you're right, everyone's programmed to go residential. And there's all these enablers out there that push it, like, from mortgage brokers. And it's the best way for someone in lower middle income class to go into that next level, because you can leverage a little bit amount of money. But the problem now is yields are getting way too low, especially versus the current interest rates. Like, even if rates come down 1-1.5%, like, it's still not adding up. And that's the problem. So you're there only for growth, and you suffer along the way. And that's the problem.
Yields are, they're not as good, but also property taxes are going up as well, like, especially in places like Melbourne.
Yeah.
So the property taxes are just rising.
So this is something I've been talking about for quite a while. There's a huge political risk in the next 10 years for Australia that no one is accounting for. And that is when the voter base shifts from wanting to buy property to knowing they're going to be forever tenants, because they're going to vote tenant-friendly policies in. So more left-wing socialist type. That's the reality of the world. Like, you see it in Europe. You see it, like, mature economies tend to go that way in many, many parts of the world. So, as we go into that space, it's going to be more reason for, political decision makers to go, well, let's give tenants the ability to never get kicked out, or you can't raise them more than $50 a week, or the land tax issue in down in Victoria. It's going to significantly lower growth rates. That's the end result, because if your rents don't go up, you're going to be capped for growth. So that everyone quoting, oh, you know, this market's grown so well for the last 40 years, it's not the equivalent to the next 40 years.
And we talk about this all the time. At the last 40 years, the number one thing that has happened in the last 40 years is interest rates have dropped from 20% down to zero.
Yeah.
And we are potentially, and this is my view, and you can give your thoughts on it as well, because we talk about it often. My view is that we are moving into a secular environment where interest rates are going to rise over the next 10 to 15, 20 years. And they'll have little dips back, but effectively we're going the other way.
Yeah, well, and no one knows. That's the trouble with it. So if that happens, yeah, it's big problems. Like something else that happened in the last 40 years, the two big other things that I have to think about straight away is, well, investors started investing in the market. They didn't really do that. Not in volume, like 40 years ago. Mm. Women entered the workforce. So you got two incomes now servicing every loan. So huge structural shifts, which kind of gave a big advantage to, like, if you had your time machine, go back into the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, leverage up, do everything you can to buy. But would that strategy work now? Because what's structurally going to change other than population growth? But I think, it's still going to go well, because the other thing is, as construction costs inevitably go up, replacement of buildings is always going to get harder. So you're probably not going to be able to, you know, build these things cheaper ever again.
We're not calling for a 40% property decline in residential or anything like that. We're just saying that the picture may not look as rosy as what it did 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And so you may have to look a little bit harder in your investment choices.
It might be, instead of getting your 7-8% growth per annum over a 10-year average, it might be four to six. Like, it's, so yeah, I don't think there's a crash coming, because there's just too many buyers waiting. But can it grow at the rate? And then is it worth copying that negative cash flow at, you know, especially as you see all these people pushing, let's build large portfolios, you know, 20 plus houses. Like, it's a completely flawed strategy. Like, you don't go buy 20 houses in lower socio-demographic areas and expect to retire. You're not going to have the cash flow. So you've got to sell down these things. And then do you sell at the right time? Have you factored capital gains tax? Is that the most efficient use of your money? Probably not, because family office, we deal with a lot of these, like from overseas to Australia, they normally have like 20 to 30, 40% of their wealth in commercial property. The big money flows into this end of town. To your point, your friend who's got some competitive advantage, that's where smart money goes. Mm. You don't go and, you know, use a strategy that's kind of, you know, for people that are just starting out at scale.
The last 3 years, I sold 14 properties all in those lower socioeconomic house and land areas.
There you go. Yeah.
Trying to diversify into the where I think the smart money is going.
Yeah, and it's more scalable, as you said. You can literally keep buying because the assets got much higher yielding, like the higher the price point as well. This is one of the issues with resi, is you spend more on residential, the yield drops because you've got less tenants that can afford to keep up with the rent of that waterfront house on, you know, wherever you're talking about. Like, you don't lease those properties, so the yields on those might be 1%.
Yeah, you're capped on those properties, right? Like, if you have a property that's worth $5 million on the water, or you have a property that's worth $10 million, you're not getting that much more rent for the $10 million property, right? So yeah, it's
in a way strategy. You're probably smart to rent that place, you know, if you want to be flexible. And that's something we did for a while. Like, we did the rent vesting thing, because again, I live on the spreadsheets. You put the net, you know, net yield, like buying versus renting, like you're getting it at multiple times cheaper. And I felt like I was cheating. It was like a cheat code. You go, we're renting on Bondi Beach overlooking icebergs for an absolute fraction of what the purchasing cost would be. You know,
I know Carson wanted to touch base on this a little bit, on the rent investing side of things.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, we've got to do better than what you're talking about before, about what we've been taught. And you look at, you know, if you're living in one of the capital cities and you can't afford to buy in your own backyard, it's being a bit smarter of, okay, well, where can we go to get your foot in the door? I mean, the thing that grinds my gears, and the reason I've got yourself on here and Kevin Dooney doing the rooming houses, is you get the glossy brochure off the plan house, and they're factoring in your 20% deposit. They're factoring in your depreciation just to try and make that number sexy,
yeah,
of what your yield's going to be. And when you compare it to commercial, yeah, like you said, resi's got its place. And to get your foot in the door, we need to do that and go outside of our backyard if we can't afford to. But then the sooner we can leverage into smarter options, the better. So I guess that would, if on the way home, if you're sitting next to a 20-year-old kid and he says, all right, that's great that you've done that if you're starting now. Mm. what do I do? Or you're talking to your son coming up. What's the game plan now in your eyes for someone that's cutting their teeth? They're only on, you know, median wage. What are you doing now?
100% start residential, freehold land, hopefully. Like, you can just buy a little house. Doesn't have to be where you live. Exactly what I did. Like, just buy the house where in 20 years it might be rezoned or whatever. It doesn't really matter, but you cut your teeth. Like, I like that word, because you don't go into commercial and have to deal with, like, how to deal with a cafe operator when he's behind his rent, and, like, you know, what if the council knocks down because there's complaints because of the VAT smoke coming out? Like, it's too much for a first-time investor. Go deal with a plain old simple house. The risk is low. Not much can go wrong. And you'll probably buy one or two more after that. So you buy a few resis, let that sort of sit in the market, do its thing over a 3 to 5 year period, and then get into commercial a lot earlier than most people think, because you don't need to be a multi-millionaire and be 20 years in the game to go into commercial. Like, you can get in a lot earlier. I wish I got into it a lot earlier, because the capital growth rates of my commercial properties have far exceeded most of my residential, especially the industrial. Like, that's been going at, like, there's an interesting stat that I saw in a, I think it was a JLL report or Knight Frank, over the last decade, the land values of industrial in Melbourne grew 281%, Sydney 280%, so 28% a year. That's beats every residential market.
Why is that, like, from a macro point of view? Is that last mile delivery warehouses? What is it?
Well, that was simply land, industrial land values. So
what's the end demand that's causing those blocks to go up?
Well, you're in the whole e-commerce boom, the changing marketplace where people are, so last mile logistics, to answer your question, there's a lot of businesses that need to store things, key things cold, like cold storage is a massive growth industry at the moment. All sorts of things. Like, you've got retail selling out of these things too, you know, like, there's a lot of, look at, like, you know, we're in Southport here now, like, there's warehouses that there's very few vacancies anywhere, like, especially ones that have good exposure. That's your showroom type one. Like, you almost never see them vacant in a good area. Like, the vacancy rate would be, you know, sub 1% for good stuff out there.
What are some of the challenges? Obviously, with commercial, you need a bigger deposit.
Yep.
Yeah. Your lending's a little bit different. What are some of the things that people need to be aware of before they jump into that space from resi over to commercial?
Yeah. So you're looking at 30% deposits. That's your big kicker. So when I first started, we were buying properties for clients like circa 500 grand. Like, we even got them under 200 back in the day, like super cheap. But those 500 grand properties are now worth 1.2, 1.5. So your entry level point, I'd say, is probably 1 mil. Reluctantly, I'm saying that, like, because there's the ones worth buying at 1 mil are few and far between. And the demand, because, like, everyone's working this out, residential yields, it's hard to scale. So, you know, you're going to see everyone just, without even being told, they'll just start looking at commercial because the mathematics forces them to do that. And then they ask all the questions, what about the risk and all that? And the smaller tenancies tend to have more risk. That's the unfortunate reality of it, because smaller businesses are either growing too quick or vanishing. You know, it's very, very few of them are stable. And if they're growing too big, they need a bigger premises or, you know, but retail could be good. Like, that's making a comeback this year because there's last year there was a million less people in the country. So there's a million more people buying stuff in Australia, and they haven't built for that, especially retail. There's an, we're sitting at 21% of the last 10-year construction volumes in terms of supply. So retail is undersupplied for the next 5 years versus, you know, all the people coming in. So that's making a recovery. Warehouses, that's been running hot. But so higher deposits. You want to keep cash buffers for a 6-month vacancy if shit hits the fan. You want to know that the leases are a lot more sturdy. So this is a legal agreement, and it's an IOU from the tenant to the landlord. You can't walk away from this. You will get sued. You know, it's basically a litigation process. There's bonds in place, personal guarantors. Sometimes the leases don't have those, but you still sue them anyway. Does it happen often? Very, not often. Because if a tenant's starting to struggle, what I see is they'll come to you and say, look, we can't pay the rent. Can I sublease the property? Because that gets them out of the liability of paying for the rest of the rent. Remember, we're dealing with businesses here, not, you know, strugglers who don't understand the way of the world. Like, this is a lot more kind of, there's business acumen involved. So you don't really deal with too much of that. unless
that's an important point with the leases. A lot of these commercial leases are like 5 by 5 by 5 by 5, and if someone takes over that lease, they're on the hook for all of that, aren't they? Unless
not the options. Options favour the tenant. Okay. Yep. So, but the entire remainder of the lease, you're on the hook for it.
Got it.
So even when I signed my first office lease for Rethink, it was just an office in Bondi Junction, and there was a company. I think they were in some medical field, but they left the country, so they were still liable for that lease. So they basically called up the agent. They have to pay for the agent and say, put it online. This is all got to get approved by the landlord, the final tenant, and they just advertised for the remainder of their lease. It was 2 years and 3 months. I signed a 2-year and 3-month lease, took over it. I bought their furniture off them. That's how sublease works. And they're off the hook for the lease. But otherwise, yeah, they'd be in trouble.
Yeah.
If the due diligence side of things, if I was going out looking at my own commercial building, I know there's some big ticket items that people need to look at. Normally roofs and air cons are probably not so obvious, because they can be, you're not just putting in a split system. They can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. What, when you're doing that due diligence piece for a client, or you're advising someone, what are the big ticket items that you're looking for and that might not be so obvious?
Yeah. So this is a complicated part. Like, so Rethink Investing, that's our buyer's agent side. We've got a whole due diligence department. We've built it up over the 10 years, it's a 100-point checklist to go through. So you don't just look at, like, you get a builder out, you do all the aircon checks, you check the, you know, every structure's legal, you got to check the square meter rates, you've got to call the tenant up, what's their succession plan, like, do they have problems with competitors, you know, is business going well, how did it go during COVID? Super high level, but you got to think on your feet, because a checklist is only as good as a standard property, and there's no such thing as a standard property. You've got to go and, like, what if you're part of a big strata and there's a, you know, a big water leak 30 floors up? So you've got to get a strata report and then review that and then work out, is that going to raise the sinking fund? And that's going to, maybe strata, you know, special levies aren't part of the lease, so that could eat into the yield. If it does, then you've got to reverse calculate the yield to then get a negotiation on the price, because if the outgoings change and your net return is affected, you've paid too much. So you've got to get that back. And that's why any time you ever buy a commercial property, make sure there's a due diligence clause in there. That's why I'll never go to an auction. Every auction property, good luck to them. That's for the lambs for the slaughter. Just go in there. Don't do, like, they'll do a bit of upfront DD, but it's too risky. You're not going to spend $5 million on a KFC and not have the ability to do a thorough due diligence, because it costs money too. Generally about 10 grand on an asset like that.
Yeah. We're playing with larger numbers, right? Like, it's like the development sites that you look at. It's not a standard due diligence checklist. These are bigger things.
And the other thing with commercial is, what I like about it is, if a tenant's not paying, it's not like in residential where they can be not paying and living in your house for months, if not years at times. Yeah. You know, you can
change locks.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they're 14 days late, you issue them a breach notice. Like, when it's happened to me, I don't even think about it. I just call my lawyer and say, do what you got to do. Talk to my property manager and they sort it out.
Yeah, it's a process.
It's simple.
And another thing as well is, like, the improvements. I've just had one where one of the tenants is moving out and I didn't even need to advertise it. The property manager already had someone else lined up. This guy was in there for a short period of time. It was a year lease. And he rang me 9 months into the lease. And he was just like, oh, man, you know, business isn't great. I can see out the lease, but if you can find someone, let me know. And anyways, they found someone. But, you know, he spent 50 grand, you know, upgrading it to 3-phase power.
Yeah.
He spent 22,000 on AC. And he's going to leave. And it's left in the property. Right. So he just improved the property, right, without me spending the money. You know, and a lot of that in residential is not the case, right? Like, this guy's not paying for my water heater that's just leaking right now, right? It's probably going to end up costing me $3,000 for a new water heater.
Yeah.
As an example. I know that's probably a bad example, because if the water heater went there, you'd probably have to replace it anyways. But, like, most tenants aren't improving properties. If anything, they're destroying them more than they are improving them.
Correct. And you got to think, most commercial tenants, like you said, are going to pay for their own fit out. or they've got their own business reputation uphold. Like, they're going to keep the property clean and tidy because customers will not take their business seriously otherwise. So you don't even need to worry about that side of things. Getting your property trashed is reserved for the odd, you know, guy storing tires on some free land like that, you know. But real tenants, like where they deal with customers, you're not going to deal with that. And 95% of the time, you're right, you will not hear from them. You're dealing with an accounts payable department, could be a big corporate. They don't even know what they're paying. They're just stamping it off and, you know, signing and delivering. But the 5% is just, like you said, you're going to run into a tenant that's not making enough money. Mm-hmm. That's the 5% you want to avoid as a first-time investor, but be prepared for it. It will happen. It's like, I'm never going to be overly positive in a podcast. I'm from the real world. 95% of the time, it's going to go really good. 5%, maybe even less, probably 2% of the time, you're going to run into that odd issue. Generally focused on the smaller tenancy side. So your goal as an investor is do what you can to get into the higher price points, because it does lower your risk. The higher you go, you're probably going to get a better yield, a better, bigger tenant, a longer lease, a better location, a better building. It just keeps getting better up the pay scale.
We spoke earlier about that entry level, $1 million warehouse being really, really crowded. Mm. And you were saying that maybe a step up from that is where you see the best opportunity. Can you talk us through where you see the best opportunity that isn't that entry level? And then, you know, some of the things that you're looking at as you get more experienced.
Yeah. No, so it's a really interesting period where we're in, because like interest rates are, you know, they've been high for a couple of years. Yes, they're coming down. There's been a huge amount of resi activity, and a lot of people are looking for the next step. What do I do with my portfolio? And commercial's the default move. It's either that or go something quite left field, not property based. But commercial is getting, it's trending massively at the moment. And the problem with that is you've got, like in Australia, you've got about 600,000 residential transactions per year. Commercial, you're looking at 17, 15, depending on the year, but it's a fraction. Imagine if
17,000.
17,000.
Wow.
And that includes land, $200 million towers, you know, anything zoned commercial. So the pocket of good deals that we're talking about, is it's very small. Mm. We've done a lot of market research, and we did a data catch just across the major websites of Real Commercial and what's the other one? Commercialrealestate.com. And you can probably see about 3,000 tenanted deals per year worth buying. And a lot of them are too low yielding. Mm. And that's under 10 million. So 0 to 10 million, that specific price point. So the 3,000, what if 50,000 of those investors come over from residential to compete against those 3,000? It's just supply demand's out of whack. Mm. So what's that? That's going to make people take extra risk just to get into the market. They're going to yield compress deals. We've already seen it, people buying just deals you wouldn't do, pay normal rate. Like an experienced commercial investor might see value at 6% for a certain deal, but then someone who doesn't know what they're doing might pay 5%. Mm. To them, they're thinking, oh, 5% net's pretty good, but that's a 20% difference in price, yield compression-wise. So
can you explain that? Obviously, we understand how that works, but can you explain the difference? And this is what people get confused, right? They're going, well, if it's a lower yield, does it mean that the price is less? So how does it work? So if you go a property, you know, earning 50 grand a year on a 6% yield or on a 5% yield, or I'll let you explain whatever example you want.
I think I can explain it is the lower the yield, the lower the perceived risk. So people are paying more for a certain amount of rent. So if the cap rate of a market is 7%, 70 grand, you pay $1 million for that asset. If the cap rate of that market is 5% and it's 50 grand, you're going to pay $1 million, but only for 50 grand of rent. So why would you pay more? Bigger lease, better tenant, high growth location, something like that. But what people are doing is they're paying more for the same risk at the 7%. So they're, and that's a 40% difference in price, by the way, 7 versus 5. So if you see that, someone's just killed off 10 years of growth or 5 years, depending on the market. So it's a huge issue. And a lot of people won't know what they're doing because they're comparing it to residential. And that's one of my predictions. You're going to have people using residential metrics and bringing it to the commercial sphere. Because before they don't even calculate net yield in resi. Like I hear it every day by some of the best experts in town quoting gross yields. And that's half the equation. Gross yield means nothing. It's the net yield. Yeah.
And the thing is, there's so many things that can go wrong. It's so hard to even, you know, quote a net yield, because all of a sudden you got to replace your roof that year.
Yeah.
You know, and it's 5 grand. And all of a sudden your yield goes from 3% to, you know, 2%. Yep. Like there's so many things that can actually go wrong in residential property. And I guess, you know, that's the risk involved. But like you said, when you're going to start, you start in residential property because you can get a higher leverage. You can get more mortgage insurance. You can still do 90% loans and pay the mortgage insurance and these types of things, or 20% loans with no mortgage insurance, whereas commercial, you already have to have a little bit of a base, really.
Yeah.
So I want to bring you back to 2015 when you bought your first commercial property. How much was that property? And what did the next few deals look like? And how did you fund those deals?
Yeah, so I funded this circa $700,000 deal. It was about
in Perth.
Yep. Yep. So it was literally like 350 one side, and it was, you know, basically 360 the other side, something like that. So very cheap, and the rents were good. I was clearing about, like, I'm really going to the memory banks now, but I think sort of like 40 odd thousand after mortgage, by the because the tenants paid all your outgoings. I had no insurance or maintenance or anything to deal with, and you know, that's kind of where I pulled the pin on my job, because I was like, well, that replaced my income at that stage. And we're getting about 150, 160,000 back then, clear for the portfolio. So, and we went to Europe for 6 months at that point, and we, yeah, didn't look back. I was starting to help people buy properties, but it was like literally friends, and I was just doing little cashes on the side because I didn't know what the buyer's agent industry was. They just saw we were holidaying and, you know, why did you leave your corporate job? I was doing that MBA, so all the questions came out of that. That's where I got my first clients, actually, from that MBA, because they just wanted to buy the same types of things we were buying. So I helped them I sourced them, did the due diligence, paired them up with the right property managers, like the whole, yeah, sweet, just here's your property. You just talk to your bank and get it done.
They wanted to buy the lifestyle,
yeah,
right? That's what people want, right, is the lifestyle. If you're not traveling Europe, they don't know, like, what's this guy doing, you know, 6 months ago? I thought he's, you know, running a corporate business. When you're running a corporate business, you know, you don't have 6 months away, right? So they start to question. And this is why we do this with Unemployable and bringing people like you on, is to give people options, right? To actually see, okay, well, you know, in the land development space, like what Shannon and Carson are doing, they can go and do 1-2 deals a year and take a whole year off if they want, and then come back and do it all over again.
Yep.
Like with you, you've got your commercial property portfolio. And if you didn't want to grow Rethink Invest or the Rethink Group, you wouldn't have to, right? You can just live off the income and do what you need to do. But obviously you see other opportunities though.
Yeah. And that, like, that's been one of the mantras from day one. Like, this job has always been there just because I wanted to do it. Like, financially, we were secure. And it's meant I've walked away from thousands of deals just because they're about the integrity. Like, it's your reputation. Like, you know, the only thing you leave on this earth is your name. So it's like, you don't make small profits or quick profits for short-term gains. And that's what this industry can be known for, you know, in the spruiker side of things. But there's very few people out there that walk away from deals that are marginal. And that's a company we've always been like. And it's, you know, I'm not living off the P&Ls. So that's the reality of the business. And as we've grown over the years, more trust has come, larger clients and more of them, and that's sort of how it grew. But you're right. Like, it was about the lifestyle. Like, I'm an engineer by trade. That's the furthest thing from the engineering spectrum people do, because they're like, you stick to your career long term. It's good money. Most of them love engineering. I sort of fell out of love with that experience on the mid-north coast. It was great, but it was like, it just wasn't worth the salary and the future wasn't great.
How did you fund the next deals, right? How do you start accumulating more and more property? Because this is where I think a lot of people get hung up, right? And they go, okay, traditional finance, you earn income, right? You pay tax, you have a certain amount of serviceability. As soon as you start adding de factos and kids and credit cards and the rest of it, that's going to affect your borrowing capacity. So the banks, you go to the bank and they say, okay, Mr. Bank, Mr. Customer, yeah, you're earning X amount a year, but you can only borrow X. Oh shit, I can't afford to get into property. Yeah. But I've got cash saved up, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
How did you do it?
So a combination of many things, like we were rent vesting. If we bought a principal place of residence early on, and God, it was tempting. Like, I was looking every week. And like the pressure from the wife was there too. She was on board with the strategy, which made a big difference. So having a partner that understands the future goal is, you know, number one, because if you do go buy a multi-million-dollar house to live in, you're finished. That's it. You're going to pay that off. It'll take you a while. Sure, you might come out the other end and buy one or two investments, you know, in your 50s, but paying a multiple million-dollar loan, non-tax deductible, it's not a strategy we advise. The other way is I was building equity through the deals. Like I bought regularly. I was doing those strata title projects. The capital growth started kicking in 2014. So the first 4 years, basically just bought three cheap properties. Wasn't spectacular. Everyone can do that these days. Well, not everyone, but like you see all the, you know, buyer's agent stories. You buy a house in, you know, whatever for 500 grand in Perth and then go to maybe Melbourne or Brisbane, like Western Corridor or Brisbane. There's ways to get into the market if you want. That's all I did. But then the market started ramping up at that point and had three houses in play, then a unit block, and then that added like some equity. So an example, I bought another unit block in Port Macquarie. It was five units on one title, paid just over 700 grand for it, strata title, and got it valued at 1.2 mil. So made half a million, call it 400 grand after costs. It's another deposit.
But the key there is you're manufacturing growth. You're not just buying something and sitting on it. So can you explain to people what you've done there, what strata titling is and how does it work?
It's that time of year again at Unemployable where we're opening up our Unemployable business coaching program. It's over a 12-month period. And with that, you get private one-on-one coaching, group coaching, as well as private and live events throughout the year. You could get private coaching with me, and not only me, but our panel of experts that we have put together. These panel of experts have been in our network and are the exact people that we use in our business successes. People from branding, sales, marketing, our lawyers, our accountants, everyone that has helped build our businesses, you have access to. If this sounds of interest, go to www.unemployable.com.au/coaching and register your interest to see if it's a fit for you and us. Hope to see you there.
Strata titling is effectively buying five units or four units, sometimes three, but more four and up on one title. You got to do work to separate them. So it's basically one title and you're changing the ownership on it. So you might have to put separate water meters, electricity. You might have to do firewall separation. Depending on the building, you got to do more or less work. So that's part of your due diligence. And when I just looked at what four, five units were worth in Port Macquarie at the time, and they were about 300 each for little property. So three times five, that was 1.5 mil. Mine, there's a one bedder, there was a three bedder. So I just shaved off that vow. It was still 1.2. I paid 700. So I had to put new car parks out there. I had to do a common area laundry type thing. So it's council specific. So you talk to a town planner, and all the other associated people, you've got to get involved. But the strategy also worked because I bought for the cash flow. The thing was spitting out a 7 to 8% return in the middle of town. There was upside in the rent. So even if none of that happened, it was still a good deal. But now could I do that strategy? Probably not, because that same unit block's worth over two and a half mil now. Like the rents haven't grown at that rate. So the numbers don't work from a cash flow point of view. And one of my biggest advices with any deal is just make sure the cash flow is good enough to support your portfolio. If you've taken so many sacrifices up front, then the equity won't come, because how are you going to get the val up to a point? Because there's a lot of valuation like this. When you're in deep with commercial, the rent dictates the valuation. It's less so in residential, but it still has a big impact. If the yields are too low, that will cap your growth. And that's why that political thing we were mentioning could be an issue. If they slow the rent of the growth of rents up long term, inevitably it will slow the growth rate, because as rents grow, investors chase yield. As investors chase the yield, they create demand, and then they're competing against owner occupiers. That pushes prices up in time. But if the rent doesn't go up, that later strategy doesn't happen.
They're doing that in Canada already.
10, 20 years ago as well, you could go to any state and find a residential property with these high yields. But obviously, when people started finding them, they started talking about them, and that arbitrage is now closed. So it's about finding.
Exactly. And that 2014 period is when I saw a lot of soup, because I was in deep into this market. Like I letterboxed dropped hundreds of unit blocks across New South Wales. So it was working. But everyone started buying them in their super funds. Mm. That was the boom at the time. And all of a sudden the yield just came down. Like, it was almost like the window closed within 12 months. So then that forced me to go onto a different website called realcommercial.com. And yeah, that the numbers were just as good as the early day unit blocks.
I don't want that to be overlooked, though. It's very, very easy for you to say, you know, I was doing hundreds of letter drops. You know, majority of people would be like, I want to invest in real estate. I want to do this. I want to do that. But they won't do the work, right? It's like what you do, Carson, right? You're setting up weeks and months of letter drops and having coffees and teas with old ladies and trying to amalgamate sites.
Yep.
This is the work that's done in behind the scenes. And then you wonder why someone's bought a property for $1 million that's now worth $1.6 million. But there's a shit ton of work. It's not just scouring realestate.com.au and Real Commercial and calling three, you know, potential deals and buying one. Like, I know Carson, they're on a 2-3% ratio. They'll go out and put 100 offers in, you know, three of them will come back and they'll maybe buy one.
Yeah.
That's a shit ton of work. Mm. So and this is the reality of it, right? And this is the thing that you may forget, right? Because now that you're at a point where you are, you kind of forget sometimes where humans are very good at forgetting, right? But you were doing the work, you were doing the letter drops, you were amalgamating sites. So this is what we love teaching is, and same thing in business is, don't just buy and hold, right? Buy and manufacture equity so you can get that instant uplift, because that $700,000 or $750,000 purchase to 1.2, that 450 grand's worth of uplift, that's your next deposit on the next property. That's how you do it. Yesterday we had Shannon Carson breaking down their 20 deals, and it was the exact same thing. It was basically a blueprint of, we bought this way, this is how we funded it, then we took this, and then we manufactured equity, and with this one, we did an option, we didn't even put any money down, and we made 500 grand, and then we took that, and you're just rolling it back into the next development. So when a lot of people, you know, sit there and look at these vanity metrics going, you know, oh, this guy's worth 150 million, wow, that's amazing. Yes, but people think of 150 million sitting in cash on a screen. Right? That's not the case in a lot of times, right? You're accumulating wealth through asset that is sitting there that is compounding over and over and over again, but it's not done within 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Like, you might have been at the right place at the right time with the right strategy and rode a wave of COVID and the rest of it that could have, you know, increased this exponentially rather than a normal cycle, as an example, right? And all of us that have been in real estate in that time have enjoyed that increased uplift. But even at any point in time, you can manufacture equity in properties, not any property, but in the right properties. And the next question I have for you is, you mentioned due diligence, right? So how many properties are you looking at and how much due diligence are you doing before you actually pull the trigger?
So earlier I mentioned, like, roughly the numbers of properties worth buying in the country. So the majority of our work is sort of, you know, under 10 mil. Like, we do 20 mil deals, but we represent individuals. So, you know, basically above us is your fund managers buying your $50 million shopping centers and stuff like that. So we review every single deal online, normally within 4 hours. Like, so we've got guys all over the country, Australia and New Zealand. That sounds like a big thing, but it's not. It's pretty easy. In fact, we've almost got it's political within my team, like who sees the property first gets the write-up, and then they have the right to do the due diligence on it, prepare it for a client. So that's a whole nother story. But imagine you're an individual coming up against, then there's our company who's reviewed it and already had a fight internally who gets the good deal. But then there's 10 other companies doing the same thing. It's like the developer, like Harry Triguboff didn't get rich by buying on, you know, the website. So you've got to pound the pavement, and that results in us doing about 80%. Well, It fluctuates. Like in a good market, like we're probably 65% off market at the moment. So we do buy a lot on market, but hopefully we've got an in with the agent. He'll tell us what the price is.
Did you 65% off market?
Off market.
Clients reselling.
Yep. Yeah. And they're like, they're true off market. This is one of the differences with residential. You know, they say off market, but it's a database email. It just doesn't have a sign out the front. But
they say off market and it's on realestate.com.
No, it didn't sell it 6 months ago. It couldn't sell 6 months ago.
I don't understand that.
I've even seen an off market sign in front of our house. I was like, yeah, I don't even know what that means. But but yeah, like due diligence. So we're looking at hundreds per week and we're buying about 55 properties a month at the moment. So I couldn't tell you the exact number we're reviewing, but they're like, we feel like it's all of them out there at the moment.
So on the, obviously Eric was talking about the value add plays and obviously you were doing that with the unit complexes. What are the, you know, as a developer, I want the value add play. I think commercial's brilliant for parking some cash and getting a great return. And obviously as the rent increases, the value increases. And so what are the, obviously you can still do strata tiling in the commercial space. I think obviously buying a vacant building and putting in the lease, obviously sometimes I think in the commercial space now you've got a lot of owner occupiers that are sometimes paying more. So I think it's area specific potentially, but what are the other value add plays besides giving it a bit of lipstick? What are the, obviously there's a lot of under-rented.
Yeah.
I think I've been mates chummy with the tenants for the last 15 years and it's 30% under rented. That happens a lot. But are there any other ones that are less obvious in your eyes? Or?
Well, look, the one you just brought up is probably the easiest one because a big part of our due diligence is we know what the rents are. If you want to find the square meter rate of a tenant in commercial, it's quite hard. You don't go on, like RPData doesn't have it. The data's not updated. So the only way to find the true square meter rates is either talking to valuers or property managers, and you've got to compare like for like. So if you see the average rate for a warehouse in Brisbane South might be like 180 a square meter at the moment, but that's net. Some are gross leases. So what's the gross lease meant to be? Like you really got to bring it back. But if we see one that's renting for 130 a square meter, game on. But why is it 130? Is it because the building's full of asbestos? It's about to get down, or does it have access issues? Is it a flood property? Like you've got to work out, is it a legitimately under rented property? And then sometimes you've got a lease which is a three year lease, but it's got three year options. So that means you've got to wait for all of those options to expire before actioning it. So your value add might not be for 6 to 9 years if there's no market review in between the leases. So you've got to check the lease. Is there a market review? Does it have a cap on it? You've got to get your lawyer to review the leases. That's how you do your proper due diligence on the lease. But something that you shouldn't forget, like how I've made most of my money and how every client has made more money is through capital growth. So all these value add plays are great, but even that unit block I mentioned, it had a quick jump to 1.2, but it's doubled since then. You know, that's where the real money is because you're not selling these things, you're accumulating. And to give you some like real high level numbers, if you go out and buy a property, $1 million property, 7% return, you're going to have to put 300K investment into that, lay off 50K for costs. So you're in the hole for about 350. Your interest rate on that's going to be, you know, 6.25% at the moment. You're going to be left with about 20 odd grand cash flow. So 20 grand over 350, that you're going to make a small percentage there. But imagine you then get 5% growth on that. You're talking nearly 20% return on equity just through getting 5% leveraged growth plus a bit of cash flow on top. Then the leverage looks better next year and it starts compounding on itself. And by like, if you get a 8% growth, you're over 30% return on investment. So that beats most development margins any day, but then you're getting it every year. And that's the beauty of it. So that's why I've been able to scale so large, because I'm just getting these returns compounding year after year. And when you get to year five, it looks fantastic. Like even the worst deal you bought looks great.
So is the strategy just buy, hold, capital growth, suck equity back out, take that and use that as a deposit for the next purchase, and using the serviceability from your business? Because serviceability still is a big play here. Just because you have a deposit doesn't mean the bank's going to give you the money.
So generally you need an interest rate cover. It fluctuates. Let's say it's 1.5 interest rate cover or 1.75%. It's harder to get a lease stock loan. This is like the holy grail of commercial property. It's how fund managers fund multi-billion dollar
So can you explain that in just in layman's terms?
So most residential guys are used to personally backing every loan. So if you don't pay, they come after you. It's not on anything other than your income. A lease stock loan, it's a loan on the lease, or it's the commercial tenant's ability to pay that. And that's the strength of commercial property, because they see it as so strong that they'll lend against it. Now there's rules. The interest rate might be a little bit higher, like 0.5% higher. If you've got a 10-year lease, they normally do a lease term of like 10 years minus 1 year. So, and I've had a lease stock loan expire and the tenants left. What happens? They don't call the loan in. Why would they want to? Because then you're going to force sell the property. The bank makes more money you're holding. So what happens in that scenario is you just got to update them. Like this happened on a property a long time ago with me. They just added a bit of interest rate on me. I was like, yeah, that's fine. Like, whatever. Do what you got to do.
So a lease stock loan is a bank that gives you the loan based on the lease that you have in place.
Correct.
So rather than going, you might have the deposit for your next $1 million property at 300 grand, but say that you don't have serviceability, right? It's been a shit year. You didn't get paid from multiple clients and you've earned minimal.
Yep.
But there's this deal that you want and there's a tenant that's already in place.
It's a standalone deal. So it doesn't look at all your other deals. Yeah. It doesn't look at your business.
It doesn't look at your visa.
Commercial loan.
Doesn't look at your visa statements. Because this is where now in the property development space that I'm in, I've been servicing everything for years, right? And earning income and paying big tax, using the big four banks, and just, whereas now I'm looking at other options, right? In that space and second tier lending and these type private equity, private lending and stuff like this. So this is something similar. Is it still a big four bank that would do that? Or is this more of your second tier Bank Wests, Liberties?
Oh, look, most of them have a product. You just talk to a good commercial broker and they'll go, that works for this type of property, because different properties have different rules too. Most fund managers operate at 50% debt levels. So again, even if you've got $2 billion as management and under management, $1 million of that, $1 billion rather, would be a loan. That's like a lease stock loan, because there's no CEO backing that loan. It's the properties itself. And there'll be a blended bunch of them in that number. But the banks are their interest rate cover is satisfied. There's a buffer in place if things go wrong. Like that's how they fund these things. Mm. So you interesting you from a development sense. One of my largest new client bases is developers. They're like, oh, it's too hard at the moment.
Mm.
Cost versus price doesn't stack up. So, but they got this money. So why don't park it up into the local shopping center or buy a warehouse?
Yeah, the key is they have money, but they don't have ongoing work. So they literally have money sitting in a bank account, but no serviceability moving forward. So that what they're doing is these lease loans.
Yeah. And they love shopping centers, for example, like neighborhood shopping centers, might be 10, 15 mil. 35% of that will be cash. You put it into the deal. The numbers look great on this. And you're buying a big freehold land that might be rezoned or multi-res one day. Like it's a good play. And it's just boring for them because they want to be really active and get all the it's a boring play, but it works. And that's you probably never sell the thing, and you get those returns I was mentioning, those leverage returns compounding on itself with 10 different tenants spreading the risk. It's pretty
the older I get, I'm speaking on behalf of myself, that I realize that the less sexy, more boring the deal is, usually the more zeros that it returns.
It's like businesses at the moment. Everyone's going for crazy new, AI type businesses, but your boring type businesses, like your carpet cleaners and all that, they're the ones actually making the money. It's like they're not going to be the 1 in 100 type business, but they're the other 99 out of 100 that work.
It's like two things that I wouldn't want to really touch at the moment is AI. Like I wouldn't want to start a business in providing AI because it's just going to be so disrupted so quick.
Yeah.
And white collar, like all the white collar consultancy roles are going to disappear. So it's almost like if you are starting out and you're not able to manufacture equity, you probably want to do a blue collar job somewhere because it's going to be in short supply.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And like all those old fashioned jobs. Yeah. Like accountants, lawyers, one of our businesses is the legal side. Like it's so hard hiring for them.
Mm.
Because no one wants to do it anymore. Like the pay is not good, but there is a long-term opportunity for people to get into those industries. Like engineers, another one, like my accountant was saying, it's all the old guys are selling their businesses and then the new ones aren't starting up. Mm. Like where I'm from, they're like, there's big firms, but the small neighborhood guy, that they're drying up.
We should touch on that as well, right? Like the macro trends are often what affect the capital growth in these investments. So, you know, like you said, off camera, you said the e-commerce boom has led to a lot of these, is led to the industrial land going up in price. And it's like, that's our job as capital allocators or people who are trying to create equity. It's to see a little bit forward into the future and to see where that next arbitrage might be as well. Yeah. You know, like you had the resi, and then you've got the commercial, and it's like, what else do we need to be looking at? What's going to be next? Because there's obviously some good money that can be made on those turns.
Yeah, well, you think about how Australia's going to deal with this construction cost issue versus that. Like, I think they're going to be, like, you own the land, you're going to do well long term. Like, there's potential rezoning because places like Sydney, the only way you can fix it's building up. So, you know, inter-rigged places and you build upwards, that's a way of putting more people in the same area. Like retail's like, and this is really against what everyone would think, retail's going to make a big comeback because of all these new people. And that I can see, like, at least for the next 5 years, there's not enough being built because it's so out of flavor. COVID's scared the crap out of people about, oh, you know, all these businesses are going to go broke. But like, are supermarkets going? Are your pharmacies? Are your local hairdressers? Like all these places.
Undersupply causes over demand.
Exactly. Yeah. And they've got more customers now. So there's still cost of living pressures, but like as we go into it, hopefully maybe a short-term dropping interest rate environment, it'll create business margin. More people are living in suburbs versus in the cities. So like you'd avoid CBDs for that and go maybe suburban type places.
And if AI does start taking some of the commercial, some of the corporate jobs, people are going to be forced to go back into physical jobs, whether it be hairdressing or something that deals with people. Right. And so that I agree with you. I think retail is going to have a resurgence. Bricks and mortar will have a resurgence.
Yeah. And we're already seeing it in the numbers. Like you can see big fund managers like, top of the top starting to deploy a bit more capital that direction. So the institutional money's starting to flow that way, really early days, because it's just been all industrial for the last decade. But I think industrial's coming off a little bit. Mm. Like you can, I'd see the vacancy reports every quarter and they're getting higher. Yeah. Mostly in the, it's just because the building margins are there because the square meter rate's gone up so high, higher than what the building's like, you know, what a build costs up 60% since 2020, something like that.
Massive.
But industrial grew more than that in many areas. So that's kept the margin intact, but not at certain sizes. So the bigger warehouses, because obviously you sell more of it, there's economies of scale for the buyer, the margin's not there. So there might be short supply in larger space, oversupply in shorter space. So you can break it down into micro details to square meter rates to local council areas. Like, it depends where you want to go.
I find the in the commercial space, well, I've been trying to make a deal stack up for ages and I just can't get one to work. And there's guys out there still doing stuff. I know on skinnier margins, I look at a lot of the places still, they're still below replacement costs. So how do you go in there and buy the dirt and build it and make a margin? It's not even about how much margin I want to build. You can't even get the finance unless you're making your 15-20%. So we've actually got a gym operator at the moment. We're looking for building any of the 50 car parks and we're trying to find like a vacant, you know, Amart we can put them into. Yeah. What kind of incentives is obviously a different thing that you get in the commercial space as opposed to the resi. What are vendors offering to tenants as an incentive to get them in the door?
So this is sort of like chapter 10 on the commercial journey. So this is the more advanced side. So, and it's good to bring it up because incentives, when you know what incentives mean, it's basically like an incentive to give a tenant free something, whether it's I'm going to contribute, like I'll give you an example. So office space in Melbourne might have a 40% incentive. So if it's $1,000 a square meter, $400 of that per square meter is funny money on the, so they show it up as 1,000 square meters on the books for the accounting point of view, but the 400 will either go into as free rent. They might say don't pay for a certain amount of months per year, or you don't pay at all for a few years, or here's cash to fund your fit out. There's many ways to skin a cat there. But the reality is, why do you need to offer an incentive? It's structurally built into the system, so it's kind of a given. So it's not just because it's a weak market, but the higher the percentage, the less rent growth you should expect. Because industrial, for example, might be sitting at 15%. So that might be like 1 month free rent per year. So your 3 year lease, here's 3 months free rent. Gives a tenant a bit of a leg up into a tenant. Like it's that's fair. But when it starts getting 30, 40%, that just tells me the demand's not there. So long term, it's, you know, your growth rate's going to be pretty flat because that needs to get absorbed somehow. But it's a way of lifting your valuations for generally the institutional fund managers. It's funny money to a degree, but
it's a fugazi.
Exactly. It's been around for longer than I've been around.
Again, they get like a macro trend, right? Office in Melbourne, office in, don't know about office in Sydney that much, but office in Melbourne is definitely struggling.
Oh, yeah, especially the secondary market. Like if prime office, it's good. Like if you're, like you guys are going to run a big successful business, you want a really beautiful office with views and like top of the state of the art fit out. You're not going to go to a 1980s, you know, with the green lamps and the, you know, horrible car.
There's plenty of those around.
They're finished.
I know a residential builder who's stuck with some office space, you know, that is that 1980s and he just can't do anything with it. Yeah. No one wants it.
And that, like, the only way to solve that problem is like, they kind of knocked most of them down when it makes sense. Mm. Again, a lot of the big fund managers are just, well, like, especially when they're backed by super funds, like they're not even operating like the real world people do. They just got $1 billion to spend every few months. So let's just rebuild this tower and then pump that with incentives and the valuation will look good and they'll make it work mathematically. Mm. But there's a call that maybe residential will start getting fitted into those if the structure allows for it. So, but residential has to be worth more than commercial, and often it's not. Commercial's a higher use in most cases.
Hmm. Or can you share some of the unicorn deals that you might have got? There's always that kind of 1 or 2%, or the you bought for a client, or maybe for yourself. Like some of the standout deals that you could maybe share with us.
Yeah. So, look, I'll start with something quite boring, but very relatable. Like we were buying huge amounts of properties in places like North Lakes and like kind of good, like Brendale, good parts of Brisbane, also around the Goldie, like Burleigh Heads and stuff, back when they were like 500. Fast forward 5 years, they're all million plus. So these, some clients bought 3 or 4 of these. One client bought about 12 offices, and since has retired and lives a good life, sold a couple of them off just for cash in the bank, paid loans off. So massive growth rates, like return enormous. Like, and it's because, especially with COVID, everyone was a little bit like, didn't know where the world was going. So anyone that bought in the, you know, any time in 2020 has made more capital growth than anyone should expect to get in the future. But they were great stories because they were really like a lot of working class kind of school teachers and stuff like that. So we've got them into a different level.
Life changing.
You mentioned North Lakes, and I know that Stockland's got a big resi development out there. Are these the kind of things that help a commercial properties as well when you've got a developer that's got 7,000 lots?
It's just increasing the, like, you know, how important this area is for business, essentially. So, yeah, big shopping centres is surely going to have some impact on warehouses. It increases land values as well. Like when you see, like we often talk about the Bunnings effect, like when Bunnings is there, it's probably a good place to invest because they've invested a lot of time into the research. McDonald's is the other one people famously quote, but big business moving into town, it's a good sign.
Is there a play, obviously, like in the development space, you get into a certain price point, you naturally, your competition goes away, so you're getting a better yield. So if you're buying a commercial shopping centre and you've got 15 tenants, is there a play of buying it, let's say you got a 7-8% yield, and then if you strata title them and then you're selling them down, you might be selling them as a, you know, to a bigger pool in that maybe 5-6% range. Yeah. Is there a play there? You're seeing anyone do anything in that space?
Yeah. So we're extremely active between the 5 and 15 mil range at the moment. And that's what I call the quiet zone of the market. This shifts every time I talk about it, depending on what happens. It's either like 3 and up, or
that's because you're looking at every single property and you've got all the wealth, and so you make the quiet zone busy.
Yeah, but it's amazing what the interest rates did, because that knocked the top end of town out. All the fund managers from 2022 basically started divesting or liquidating rather than acquiring. So the quiet zone was super quiet. If you were around with a budget of 20 mil over the last couple of years, you would have got the deal of the century, because they're all sitting at the wheel dealing with too much debt and they can't distribute enough to their investors. So private investors had a much higher percentage of acquiring versus them. and it's still much higher. They're going to come back when the interest rates drop because they can start making their disbursements work again. But again, they're not there yet. So that end of town's struggling, especially if they bought at times 2020 or 2022, because they're just going to be sitting on too much debt because they leveraged up. And but the private investors are making the biggest moves. But the 5 to 10 mil range is, we've had a couple of really good deals recently. Like we bought one in Tassie. It was just like a showroom type place on a main road, and it was, the market rent was 275 and this thing was renting for 110 over a 7 mil deal. Crazy. The replacement value on it was, this is an insurable replacement value. The lowest we could get it down was 14 mil. And we had it valued up sort of, 15, 16. If the tenant goes and we started fresh and got someone to pay $275 a pop for, so that's the rent increase play.
One of the best deals I've seen in a long time, it was here in Southport, and they actually did a material change of use. And what that is basically, if you're changing the zoning of the property, right? So it was originally zoned for industrial, but it was kind of in a residential kind of retail-ish area.
Yeah.
And it was just old storage sheds. That was probably market rate, 150 a square meter, something like that. And there was just a bunch of them, like 7, 8 of them just in a row. And the developer went in and did a material change of use to retail, and he renovated them. Beautiful arches. And they're just occupying now. There's restaurants and there's like a hot and cold plunge, spa there. And now he's getting, between 600 and 700 a square meter rent, but he bought it at the 150 yield, absolutely killed it.
And that's what I think that's one of the best strategies to get, because you can see it before you buy it. We got two very similar deals in Tassie. One was just a little bit cheaper with a little bit less upside to that, but like two deals in a row. So like with two instant multimillionaire profits to the clients, and family office bought one and private investor bought the other. Like these are deals you just don't get off the shelf.
What's the best state at the moment? Where is the best state to be looking at?
Depends how you look at it. Like the one that's moving the fastest is Perth at the moment. Arguably it's later in the property cycle. It's pretty hard to get a good yield there now because of the sheer demand from investors. You would have seen it over there in the resi side. So that's flowing into the commercial. Land values are going up. Economy's pretty strong there, so people are confident in it. But I've been around long enough to see what happens to Perth as well. It has a super quick run, and then it'll go quiet for five, six, seven, 8 years.
Where are we about to see the turn? Because you can make the most money on the turn. Where do you think that's going to be?
We're starting to get down into Victoria a lot. Like everyone's worried about the land tax, but commercial, we buy properties where the commercial tenants pay the land tax.
Yeah.
So we're actually getting yields of 6% plus in a market which is historically 4.5% yields. So that yield differential is really in our favor at the moment. So there's risk with it. There might be a change of government. Who knows? Mm. Imagine they pull the land tax out again. Anyone that got in now with the assumption it's there forever has done very well. So that's one market. Sydney's priced pretty well in some areas. I love the long-term growth story of Southeast Queensland. Like you can't go wrong here. Mm. Got the Olympics. You've got most people wanting to live here. It's every time I come to the Gold Coast, it's a different place. And same with Brisbane. Like it's a way where the middle income class can actually live a lot better than other parts of the country at the moment. And
I agree.
And that's going to hold weight for a capital growth point of view.
So how does Rethink Group work and Rethink in investing? So if people, I'm going to grab your mobile number after this. We're going to be catching up. So how can people, what services do you offer? And what makes you guys different than another commercial buyer's agency?
So it all started with Rethink Investing. I started as residential, but we always went high yield because that's what worked for us personally. So it was based on our own portfolio. But like I said, I had changed in 2017 to commercial. That was 2 years after I bought my first commercial. I bought a few others in that time. I was like, this worked way better. Let's just get clients onto it now. So I always try myself first. And since then, we've done, you know, $5.5 billion in commercial, and we're doing over $100 million a month as well. So we're good volumes, and that gives us access to good off-market stock. I think we review every deal out there, unless there's just some rogue deal here or there that misses because someone else has got a good contact. It's contact-based. None of this is rocket science. The due diligence can be tricky, but, you know, I'm from the engineering world where you're doing structures on bridges, calculations. That none of that is, like, this is easy type stuff. Like, you just got to buy, and it's a common sense approach. You need a bit of business acumen, but, like, you just don't make a dumb decision and you'll be fine in this space. But it's access to the people. That's the trick. It's who you know, not what you know. And like, so we get sent deals off market all day. They send it to us because they don't want to go online. They don't want other agents trying to poach their listing. They like the simplified process. Like, I was talking to an agent who listed a Hungry Jack's late last year, and he had 700 and something inquiries on one deal. So you call me up. If the price is right, you know, it's one call. Done.
And it's private as well, right? Like, when people know that you own that Hungry Jack's, and next thing you know, it's on Real Commercial, everyone's like, oh, look, John's selling his Hungry Jack's. What's going on, right? Whereas business, when it's off market and goes straight to you, no one knows. They still think you own it. 5 years later, you tell them, I haven't owned that in 5 years.
Yeah.
So, I like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a private world. And that's, like, to answer your question, why are we different? We're the largest by mile. We're probably 3-4x times bigger than our next competitor. And that just gives us access to the stock. We've been around a decade. Reputation's everything. We would have been found out if we weren't doing good deals. So just Google and you'll see. But off the back of that, we're doing huge volume. So I did the vertically integrated business model. So, you know, we had all these loans going through, and I was sick of using residential investors and their mortgage brokers who didn't have a clue about what a lease stock loan was or how to finance an industrial site or a development site. Mm-hmm. So we brought that all in-house, created Rethink Financing. That took off and grew really quick. And then got the legal side, insurance business, Rethink Commercial Education, like online education platform. Hundreds of people are doing that. And that's basically just going really deep into everything we're talking about. You know, you can go into that and go, what's an incentive, or what's a, you know, how to work out the cap rate of a market, how to get an off-market deal. It's all there in that course.
Teaching them how to fish.
Yeah. And it's telling us how to, telling them how to do our job. And I was a bit wary when I first started creating it, going, well, we've given it all away. But the real answer is most people still want help to find the deal and do the due diligence, because due diligence takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And we've got 10 odd staff that just do that full time. And they know what to do. They call the agents up. They've got all the access to the data and where things are at. You don't want to do all that yourself in a 21-day period. So that's pretty tricky.
What does it normally cost? So if we were to hire you guys as a buyer's agency looking at a commercial property, is it a sliding scale depending on the cost of the property? How does it work?
So we just charge 1.9%.
Yep.
There's a cap of 14,900. Like, so basically when it goes under 800 grand, there's a cap.
Yeah.
The 1.9% just goes up to any price point, mostly, well, basically because the deals are better at that range. So you're generally going to make our fee back through upside 4 or 5 times over on those deals.
Pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
So 1.9% plus GST.
And then you got to remember, that's right, sales agents will charge that or more just to sell it. So we've got to do all the DD, and we only get paid if it settles. So we get paid at settlement. So we don't get paid when it goes unconditional. It's got to be in their hand as a deal done. So we have a crash rate of about 10%. So 90% of the deals we put under contract go through, 10% crash. The reason they crash, mostly outgoings are underestimated. There's not much misleading stuff that goes on, but there's a bit of ignorance with some agents, or the owners haven't supplied all the information, or the classic bad building report, or we call the tenant up and it turns out his uncle's got some investigation and, you know, he's going to go insolvent soon. I don't know. There's always random things that pop up 10% of the time.
When is that paid? The 1.9%
settlement.
A settlement. Yeah.
So we don't get paid if we, and we're the first to tell you to walk away from a deal, because I don't want my brand on that if it's a bad deal. Yeah. So we'll say, look, bad news, even though we've done a 70-page due diligence report for you and wasted 3 weeks, let's look for the next deal.
Is there any upfront payment just to make sure that, you know, you're not just wasting time with tire kickers, or you're on due diligence on us?
We've got a $2,900 odd fee. So basically, and that, you're right, it's to the tie kick aside.
Well, you could be working for free for 100 people and no one's going to buy anything if you don't.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, because we deal with a lot of super high net worth. They have the biggest issue with the 3,000. It's like,
that's how they got there.
It's $3,000. It's like, and they're like, no, just find me a good deal. Send me when a good one comes up. I'm like, I've done that about 20 times. And all 20 times, they never ended up buying. So it's like, you give me something free, there's no commitment. There's no... It's just a bad business call. So I don't do that anymore.
How do you, like, you've obviously got a lot of people looking for properties. How do you kind of put people in the queue and, you know, if they're all looking for the same type of property?
That's the science. Like, it's chronological, like those who've waited the longest get it, but they're all got different briefs, different price points. So
different areas.
The waiting list is quite large in the sub 1.5 mil. It might be 6 months at the moment. Might be 3 months from 1.5 to three. The waiting list drops as you go higher.
If we wanted to get a couple of us together, like, where is the prime price point?
No, that's probably off camera.
Yeah,
that's unemployable talk. Okay,
yeah.
I'm giving you a call for Victoria because I'm originally from Vic.
So. Now there's some good deals down there. Like, we're doing a lot of industrial, a lot of retail down there.
Commercial typically follows the resi market. Is that as a normal trend, if the resi market jumps, the commercial follows behind it, essentially? Yeah. So is there a play, if, because Melbourne's going to go at some point, in my eyes, you look at the gap between Sydney and Melbourne, typically, historically, it's been reasonably close. Melbourne just trails behind Sydney, but the gap at the moment is quite large. So in my eyes, that's got to come back. Melbourne's growing, you know, still a fast-growing city. Yeah. And then I think once you see that commercial space, I mean, the resi space go, you know that commercial's going to come in behind it as well. So,
well, I'm glad you even said that it does follow pretty similar, because property is, it's like the macro, you know, side of the economy is what really drives it. So interest rates, population growth, like build costs, that kind of keeps everything within a band. Mm. So yes, it does operate at different place. Spots like, we're in New Zealand at the moment. They've had 1.75% of interest rate cuts as of today. The commercial market started moving pretty quick, so they're more sensitive to debt than resi. So resi will move slower because you've got more emotion, more, you know, just people aren't worried as much about the interest rate as commercial. So in a downward interest rate cycle, you'll see faster growth for commercial. But yeah, to answer your question, Melbourne, it's currently sitting at like 50% of the average house price of Sydney. Historically, it's about 75%. So there's a 25% potential margin that's either going to come via Sydney dropping, which is probably unlikely, or them playing catch up. When will that happen? No one knows, but probably over the next few years.
When they get rid of the Labor and the Greens.
And if that happens, yeah, you're right. All the property-friendly policies.
You want to get in before that, in my opinion.
But you got to plan for what if it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's what, like, just make sure you're happy with the yield.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you are, then it's probably a good deal.
The beauty with this is, like, due diligence takes a very long time. I know Gold Coast mainly, right? I don't know Melbourne very well. I never lived in Melbourne. I've obviously visited, got, you know, friends there and whatnot. But for me to then go and try and become an expert in due diligence in Melbourne would take me a long, long time. And for me, it's like, okay, what's the path of least resistance? So I got to pay somebody a $3,000 deposit up front that's an expert in that area, and then pay 1.9% of a purchase price that they're going to go and they're going to justify, right, that price anyways in the actual deal. So it shouldn't be costing you anything, because if they're putting you in the right deal, that's why you're paying them.
Correct.
So for me, it's a very short-term thinking. If you're like, well, why am I going to pay someone, you know, $30,000 on my $1.5 million deal when I could just go do it yourself? And you can screw it up very, very easily. Because I'm assuming you got experts in Victoria, New South Wales, Brisbane. They know, and when you get a 70-page or a 50-page document saying, this is why, here's the population growth, here's the vacancy rates, here's the yields.
It's all
there for you. So you're paying for that service. I think it's well worth it.
Well, it's like in New Zealand. Like, I'm not super familiar with most parts of New Zealand, but we've got guys on the ground and they're just, they've grown up there. They know exactly, like, they've developed there, they've bought commercial properties there. They're experts, they're financial planners in the area. And they're working in the team. So yeah, it's just, you need your numbers.
Like, and is it true there's no capital gains in New Zealand as well, right?
Or stamp duty.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good going. So there is a really good, that's the other opportunity there. New Zealand, because
talk about that one.
they had a government which punished commercial property investors, and their Reserve Bank was a lot more aggressive. So they went up into the mid 5% for their Reserve Bank. So they've now come back 1.75%. They've just had another 50 basis rate cuts, and they're predicting another 1% as well. So all of a sudden, the interest rates dropped to 2.5-3% from peak to bottom. You know, what do you think is going to happen to prices? But the interesting thing is prices have come off about 30-40%.
Mm.
I was going to expand the business back in 2021 because we were ready. Because we're getting calls from New Zealand investors all the time. They follow Australia very closely. Obviously, it makes sense because we dictate what would happen to them to a degree. They've got their own growth drivers, of course, but they all follow suit to a degree. Like we follow the US, probably 12 months behind. Canada, similar. But I didn't go there because the interest rate versus the yield made no sense. They were selling warehouses in Auckland at 4% yields. You can now buy the same deal at 6%. So even if that 6% goes back to 4%, you made 30-40%.
Yeah. It's a big difference, those 1% and 2% in yields.
A
lot of
people overlook. It's a ratio. It's a huge difference, yeah.
Guys, I can't believe we've been going for almost an hour and a half already. It's right up our wheelhouse, this commercial stuff. Us resi guys, you know. Yeah. But yeah, obviously, Scott, you're a wealth of knowledge, and anyone that spends the time and effort coming on the Unemployable podcast, we really appreciate it because this is what we do. What we do is to try and change people's lives, right? Whether it's them buying a resi property or a commercial deal. And I love what you said, and it resonated with me so much. You know, it was the teacher or the nurse that all of a sudden you've changed your life, you know, by getting them into the right deal. And that's what we're about at the same time is there's a lot of people doing it tough out there, and there's a lot of noise out there. Is it resi? Is it commercial? Is it office space? Is it industrial? You know, there's just so much. And that's why we're creating this podcast, is just to get as much information out there so people can consume, at their leisure and take what they want from it. So really appreciate your time and effort. Obviously, I know I could be a lot of places. And thanks for being here.
That's a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Hey, Carson, great. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the hookup, man. Just reaching out.
Look, it's just everyone can do better. Like the stock standard, just like you said, buying 10 houses or even the average person will get one investment property. But being a little bit smarter, thinking about the yield, thinking about how you're growing a portfolio, you're going to tap out at, we're going to not have enough yield, you're not going to have enough equity, and just be thinking about, commercial and then whether it be development, whether it be reno flips, it's all got its place. Yep. But yeah, I'm just stoked that you came in and shed some light on it. It's awesome. Thank you.
Appreciate it, guys.
I agree. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. That was awesome.
And as usual, guys, share the podcast around, like it, subscribe. Don't forget to comment, and hopefully you enjoy it, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.